I would say when I first ran Desert Solstice in 2013, a huge driver to me wanting to kind of go back to those type of courses or those type of events was to target the world record for 100 miles. And it took me about just under 6 years to finally get there. And through that process, I think I actually learned what I was actually motivated by. I think like you get anyone who has a long ultra running career, I can almost guarantee you their goals and their objectives have evolved to some degree over the course of that. I think that's what keeps them in it mentally. So for me, one of those kind of transitions was I ended up getting a little more interested in just what is it that I can actually do in this sport of ultra marathon running in a controllable 100 mile, like how fast can I go?
Hey, welcome back to the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast, where we talk about what it takes to go the distance in running and in life. I'm your host, Eric Dieter. I'm an ultramarathon runner and a mindset coach. When trail runners get together to run a few miles, we never know where the conversation is going to go. So if you're ready, let's get started. My guest this week is Zach Bitter. Zach is an ultramarathon runner. He is a coach. He's also a podcaster. His podcast is called Human Performance Outliers. Zach has set multiple world records and American records in running, including the world record for 100 miles. We have a good discussion about training and nutrition as well as running. Hope you enjoy this conversation with Zach Bitter. Thank you a lot, Zach, for being here. I appreciate you being part of the show.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks a bunch for inviting me.
Yeah. And I found you, I can't remember I'm always looking for people on social media. You came across my social media and I thought, wow, that's cool. You've got a lot of stuff going on. And I thought, would love to pick your brain about some of the experiences you have.
Sure. Yeah. I always love doing the podcast format. It's fun to chat and
yeah.
And dive into some stuff.
Yeah, so for people who don't know you, and I mean I don't know a lot of your history. I always kind of ask, how did you start as a runner? I mean you've got a world record. You had a world record for a while. I thought, where did you get your start?
Yeah, I got my start, I guess technically running, pretty early in middle school, before I was introduced to kind of track and field day and the Presidential Physical Fitness Challenge. I just kind of assumed running was more or less part of other sports.
And yeah, that's kind of the way it's presented in school. The track people are kind of like, oh, well, you know.
It's a means to an end a lot of times. Yeah, I think like if you got a football coach who really knows what they're doing, they'll a lot of times tell their players to go out and do track and field, whether it's sprinting or some of the more power-based events like the jumping, the throwing, stuff like that. But then, yeah, you get the distance group, which is kind of a little bit of a blend between the kind of cross-country and, you know, kids who are just kind of like exploring the different sports and things like that. So that was kind of a fun time, I think, to get introduced to the sport. And for me, I was pretty fortunate, and my parents weren't like real forceful about doing any one particular sport or anything like that. It was basically just, you know, stay busy, be doing something. But outside of that, you know, it's kind of up to you. So I would try out all sorts of different sports, and running was kind of the one that stood out after the first few years is the one I was probably a little bit better at. And that kind of steered me towards a little more of a focus of into track and cross country in my later years in high school. And then I eventually went to the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point. And when I saw they had a track and cross country team, I was like, well, they have it, I might as well try out. So mm-hmm. I met with a coach and spoke with him and kind of figured out what it was going to take to be a collegiate runner, and kind of quickly realized that I needed to start running a little bit more than I had been historically. Which is funny because, I mean, most people who look at my ultra running career would certainly call me a high mileage or a high volume distance runner, and I certainly am. But my transition towards that was very gradual, which I think is part of the reason why I'm able to kind of still do it, is I didn't really destroy myself in development by doing like 60, 70, 80 mile training weeks when I was in high school and things like that. I was 30 miles is probably about the furthest I went in a week in high school. And then college is when I kind of started getting up into like the 50 mile per week range, and that kind of just inched up over college and after college, you know, before you know it, I was doing high mileage stuff. And that's kind of what I learned worked for me in my, from my collegiate experience, and it helped me identify what workouts were my favorite. And when I had to kind of pick between short intervals, tempo runs, long runs, and all that, all the stuff that kind of comes with it, I kind of like the long run the most. So I spent a couple of years after college basically just building volume, doing a lot of long, slow stuff. And that kind of led me to ultra marathon, I guess.
Okay. Okay. So you said that you were in, were you in high school then when you were looking at college? So you, did you get a scholarship then? Is that
I did.
I wasn't sure whether you were like a walk on to the team in college or whether you, mm-hmm. you made the plans to run before you got to college.
Yeah. So in high school, you know, I was good enough by my senior year to make the state meet, but I wasn't getting recruited by the D1 schools outside of, I don't think I had any recruitment from any of the D1 programs. I know I had some scholarship offers from some D2 schools, relatively smaller, lesser known ones. And then D3 was where I ended up going at Stevens Point, which is not a scholarship based programming in Division 3. So then it was just basically, they would recruit, the top D3 schools are often recruiting, and I wasn't one of the candidates, but they're also, since they're not giving out, you know, they're not giving you any money to be there from a financial aid standpoint or, you know, a scholarship standpoint, then they're pretty open to people walking on too, because it's like for them, it's what's the loss if someone they didn't vet and find out develops into a great runner and they would want to be there, then they're pretty open to it, which is kind of a cool setting as well. So I very much walked on though. I didn't really necessarily plan to run in college at first, but then when I picked Stevens Point and met with a coach, I thought, you know, let's just do this. Why not? What's the harm? And that kind of is, I would say college is where I really started wanting to understand why I was doing what I was doing versus just kind of knowing I had some potential and knowing that the coach probably had the best path forward for me and just listening and doing. College was probably where I started thinking, okay, that's cool that we're doing this workout today and that one the next day and this stuff, but why are we doing that? And started to kind of pry into that a little bit and understand some of the different ins and outs and what these workouts were actually doing for me from a race performance standpoint. And that kind of curiosity, I think, just grew as I got further out of college too. And certainly now that I kind of run as a professional in ultra marathon stuff, it's, you know, part of the process for sure is kind of staying on top of what's working and what's not working and finding out kind of the best path forward and understanding that sort of stuff.
So was that kind of attitude, what led you into looking at coaching, or when you got out of college, you didn't become a professional runner right out of college. So
no, definitely not. Yeah. So my original career path was a teacher, and I did that for about 5 years before kind of stepping away from that in order to focus a little more on running and coaching. But with that, there were some kind of transition phases, I would say. And one of them was like kind of when the parallel of kind of learning the ins and outs of the hows and whys of the workouts and things like that put me in a position when I started teaching middle school and high school for a few years, I had some opportunities to coach. So it was like, okay, now I have this opportunity to kind of test out the stuff I learned and see how it works and how you adjust things for different athletes and their strengths and weaknesses. And when you have, like, you know, that full team, you kind of get that opportunity to look at it through a lens greater than just your own personal things. I think a lot of times coaches, first thing they do is, well, this worked for me, therefore, and then they just kind of like put that on paper. And then you start to realize, well, this is kind of where the research says you should be heading for this particular type of training. But then there's the individual components, everything that kind of comes with that. And then you make adjustments accordingly to kind of, to match that stuff up to the individual versus population level stuff. And that's kind of where I started learning that was working with middle school and high school athletes with that. And then I had some success running while I was still teaching in the ultra running world. And that kind of opened up some opportunities with sponsors, as well as I had some friends reaching out asking, hey, you want to coach me for this, you know, 50 miler or this ultra marathon here or there. And, you know, so I started just kind of, you know, taking on some one-on-one clients too. And that started to grow enough to the point where that combined with athlete partnerships, I was kind of in a position. What I say is, like, if I really wanted to be 100% there as a teacher, I was going to have to step away a little bit from what I was doing with the coaching and training stuff. Or if I wanted to really be 100% present as a coach for runners at the individual level and kind of train specifically for what I was trying to do and kind of approach that, I'd have to step away from teaching. And, you know, for me, it's a hard decision, probably one of the harder decisions I've made, but ultimately when looking at it through the athlete lens, it was like, this is the short window of time versus, you know, how long you can make a teaching career last. So I thought, well, let's just give it a try. And worst case scenario is I completely fail and go back to teaching in a couple of years. Best case scenario is I, you know, have a career running for however long that ends up being. And then at the end of that, I can decide what I want to do with like my time and energy. So for me, fortunately, it's been, you know, just kind of a gradual progression in terms of like what I've been able to kind of add on to the, just the training and racing side of things. And that's kind of put me in a position to make a kind of a career out of it.
Okay. So what were your first kind of, when you were teaching, what was kind of your progression in races? I mean, ultra marathons, it was still, you know, a lot of people are getting into it now, but that way, you know, it's still kind of an outlier for a lot of people. So what was your progression there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So after college, I sort of stepped away from speed work for a little bit. I basically was like, okay, I'm kind of sick of that. I'm going to focus on what I want to do. And any part of that was also just, you kind of go from an environment where you have a team and you have a coach and everyone kind of just gets on the program more or less and you do it. And then after college, I didn't really have that set up any longer. So I knew I wanted to run, but I didn't really have a whole lot of direction as to what I wanted to do, other than I knew I wanted to do longer stuff than the traditional like 5K, 10K type range that we'd see in college. So I just started running more, not a lot of speed works, kind of building volume. And that probably helped me kind of tolerate that a bit, since I was, when you look at it from just a training load standpoint, you know, you're increasing volume or intensity, but you got to be kind of careful if you're getting too aggressive, increasing both at the same time. So I spent a couple of years basically doing that. And that kind of led me towards kind of focusing, training for some marathons, slightly unstructured. I mean, I wouldn't say I ever really did a great marathon buildup training plan where I kind of checked all the boxes and what you would consider mm-hmm. a good program, but I did do some marathon racing as just like a way to kind of keep myself motivated in training and have something on the calendar. And I got to kind of the end of that progression and I did start doing some more speed work again. And then 1 year I was looking at just the races kind of in the area I was living in, Wisconsin. And it was like, oh, I didn't even realize there was ultra marathons in this state. So it shows how much I knew about the sport at the time. And there was one that kind of lined up with the timeline I was looking at. And I thought to myself, I was like 24 at the time, like, maybe I'll just try this 50 miler and just see what it's like. And then my thought was, I'll probably learn something and then step away from it, go back to marathons for, you know, the better part of my 20s, then maybe get an ultra marathons in my 30s. And as fate would have it, I really enjoyed that experience. And I waited a whole nother year to do another one, but by that same time the next year, I ended up doing 350 milers in like a 9 week period of time. So I was hooked at that point. Yeah. So 2012 onward, it was ultra marathons as the focal point. And, you know, I did a couple more marathons, I think, just as like kind of training races and things like that, but mostly focusing on things like kind of 50 miles and further. And now I would say my main focus is kind of the 100 mile distance.
Mm-hmm. So when did you get kind of having the attention from sponsors? I mean, were you competitive in those? I mean, I'm taking it you were competitive in those early races. So was that
something
that kind of your focus to compete?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I had a bit of an interesting kind of progression, I would say. I the sport of ultra running in North America is very heavy, or at least it was much heavier out west, and it was very skewed towards the trails. It still is to a large mm-hmm. degree, but I think as the sport's grown quite a bit, everything's gone up somewhat. So you have these opportunities to do more regional localized races that can kind of get a name for yourself at those. But when I got in, it was still very much developing on that side of things. I think if you really wanted to nail an athlete sponsorship, you probably had to go out west and do well at a couple of the bigger trail races out that way. But there was also, I think that what that also did is it gave a little bit of an opportunity to, help some other areas of the sport grow a little bit. You know, I did my first ultra in 2010, and that was kind of right as the sport started to have that upswing again, where we had a bit of a dip in ultra running for the better part of a couple decades leading into that year. And then it started getting interesting again, as I think internet and social media made it more accessible for people. We had guys like Dean Karnes write books that, you know, went very popular into the mainstream. So now people knew what the sport was versus having no clue. It was just like kind of these niche sport where, like, if you knew it, you knew quite a bit about it. But if you didn't, you didn't know anything about it. And there wasn't a whole lot of middle ground. Now I think the average person is aware of ultra marathons because it's had enough mainstream attention. And that just gives it a little bit of a better feeder into the sport, I think. So in 2013, another thing I didn't learn until I kind of slapped me in the face was that you could do these races that weren't necessarily on the trails. My first perception was like, well, ultra marathons are just basically done on the trails, and that's how it is. That's just where the sport is. And then I did a road 50 miler in 2011, and it kind of, I wouldn't say I had a great performance, maybe relative to where I was at the time. But one thing clicked was just like, I felt like I was able to really tolerate the day and manage myself a lot better. And part of that was just because I was doing a lot of training on relatively flat, some rolling hill roads, but a lot of pavement, not a lot of trails. So it just translates better. I mean, it's like anything specificity wise, if you have that specific training environment to where you're going to race, that's going to be something you can leverage. And I kind of noticed that. And that kind of put me in a position where I had a couple good races on paved courses, and it drew the attention of the Desert Solstice Track Invitational, which is an invite only ultra marathon timed event up to 24 hours, where they like to recruit people to go after age group records, outright records, but basically 50K to 24 hours essentially. And I got invited to do that race in 2013, and it was my second completed 100 miler and my first technical 12 hour timed event. And going into that event, I didn't even know there was a 12-hour timed event. I was actually told at around mile 90 that I was on pace for the world record for 12-hour timed event. I was like, oh, cool. I kind of came here to target. I went into that race thinking I had a shot at the American record for 100 miles because it had just been broken by a guy named John Olson earlier that year. He was the first American to break 12 hours in 100 miles. He ran like 11:59 and some change. And I remember thinking I had just run 5:12 for 50 miles at the Chicago Lakefront 50 mile. And I thought to myself, like, you know, if I could just like essentially run a 5:45 for the first 50 mile, I mean, if I can hang on, I'm going to get under 12 hours. And that was about all the thought process I put into the race strategy at the time. And, went out there on that invite. And I think I split right around 5:45 for the first, 50 miles. I might've been a shade under, but, you know, I ended up, coming through 100 miles in 11:47, which took about 12 minutes off the American record for 100 miles. And like I said earlier, at around mile 90, Nick Curry, who was the co-race director at the time, was like, hey, just so you know, keep doing your thing with the 100 mile stuff. But when you hit 100 miles, don't stop because you're on pace for the 12-hour world record. And I remember thinking to myself at that time, like, first of all, I didn't even know there was a 12-hour world record. And second, I didn't really realize how much of a mental process this sport was, because I had to, like, just before he had told me that, had just basically confirmed in my mind that I wasn't going to be able to go a second faster per lap. So Desert Solstice on a 400 meter track, he's just super controlled. Yeah. And, ended up running like 3-4 seconds per mile or per lap faster after getting that information. It just dawned on me. He's like, oh, if you go into these things with some areas where you can kind of really change the mental dynamic of how you're feeling, you can really move the needle on the actual output physically. And that was kind of my first real clear look into that, and recognizing that, like, your mind is gonna try to tell you that things aren't doable that are doable in these late stages for 100 mile races. And you need to kind of recognize that so you don't find yourself making excuses, when the going gets tough, so to speak. And, that was very helpful and having that experience, I think. And it was like probably the first race that was noticeable enough that it drew some attention from some of the companies that are sponsoring ultra athletes. And that kind of got me heading in the right direction, at least. And then I just started kind of building my career around targeting flat runnable 100 milers. And, you know, that led to, as the sport continued to grow too, a lot of other opportunities come up with, like, podcasting as a host. I did that a little bit later in the career, but I was going on podcasts a ton in the beginning. And I was a little late to kind of social media, I would say. I didn't really enjoy that format quite as much as podcasts, but it was something that I recognized at some point in the career. Is like, yeah, this is something you can leverage a bit if you're just open about what you're doing and sharing it on social media. People like to follow that and see that, potentially learn from it. Sponsors love to see it, obviously. So it's like you kind of have these different areas where you can make yourself marketable for a company that wants to support you and what you're doing. And it can be kind of a mutually beneficial arrangement with at that point. So that was kind of the first catalyst. And you know, 2015, I broke my own American record at 100 miles. And then in 2019, broke the world record for 100 miles in 12 hours and had some fun races kind of on the trails as well. I didn't completely abandon the trails. I like to, I do like to use them. One thing I really learned more recently was that there is this like mental attrition, I think, where if I just decide to like always target, say, two or three flat runnable 100 milers every year, you get to a point after maybe a few seasons of that where like you just don't quite have that same sharp motivation that you did when you first went after it. Cause you're kind of repeating a lot. There's a lot of kind of the same thing over and over again. You get a lot more monotonous environments, especially if you're doing your long runs on a track. And I noticed that there is some value in saying, okay, I'm going to take half a year or, you know, a third of a year and just get off the roads, get off the track, go out on the trails, do some climbing and descending, completely change the focus for a build up, do a race like that, and then come back. And then it really does help with the mental side of things. I also think physically it's good too, because running ultra marathons is slow, relatively speaking, when you're on race day stuff. So you're doing a lot of stuff that is slow running on flat surfaces aren't necessarily, I think, great from an injury prevention standpoint if you're not including a lot of like supplementary stuff. So the trails I also think are a great way to kind of keep your body, your skeletal muscle system, things a little more balanced. So kind of throwing that stuff in there now and again, I think is just really good for the longevity of both the physical and mental side of stuff for me. And that's kind of how I kind of look at the landscape when I'm planning out races now.
Yeah, that brought up a couple of things I wanted to ask you. But first off, I wanted to ask, how do you prepare yourself mentally for running on a track? Because I mean, a lot of trail runners would hear 24 hours on a track, and they think there is no way that they would want to do that mentally.
Yeah.
and then talk a little bit, what about your expectation, you know, that you said that your mindset shift actually helped you speed up because your mind had been set on 100 miles and then you got this news and you were able to run faster. I mean, that, mm-hmm. what was going on in your mindset when you were for your plan, your strategy, and then being able to shift it?
Yeah, I think the way I've looked at the mental side of the sport has evolved quite a bit over the course of my career. I think it's always part of it, right? You probably don't end up doing ultra marathons if you're not like willing to kind of put in some hard mental work. I think specific to the track, for me, I think with anything that is like that, where you have yourself in this, there's things stand out, right? I mean, you think 400 meter track and you're like, okay, that's gonna be monotonous, one-dimensional, super boring. So that's the first thing that pops in your mind. But if you give it like a second pass or another look and you will say, okay, so those are the negatives. Well, what are the positives? Well, the positives are you've basically eliminated any opportunity of getting lost. If you get lost on a 400 meter track, that's all on you. You can't blame the race director. You can't blame your crew for that. You literally can get access to any like fluid or nutrition that you want every couple of minutes, essentially. And if you screw it up, I mean, 2 minutes isn't going to make or break your race. So you have it then on the next lap. So you have this situation where you really minimize a lot of the logistics. You have a lot of control over things. You can see like, oh, I'm actually performing worse this hour than the last hour because my lap splits are slower and there's no elevation, no weather. Well, I mean, you can get some weather change, but rarely, you usually don't go to those events if it's really bad weather, because it's like, why would you run around a track on a controlled fast surface when it's like 100 degrees out? Cause it's just not, people are chasing times usually there. So it's like, it's not really conducive for those events. You just don't see a lot in that type of weather. You start finding the positives of it where, okay, I can really kind of focus in to what I thought of as just like this, like almost meditative flow state out there. Cause you're not thinking about tripping over a root or a rock. You're not thinking about how do I change my cadence when I'm going up this hill versus down this hill, and all these other things that come into like kind of the trail side, which are exciting aspects of that side of the sport, but they're also logistical hurdles you have to get over. So like knowing that you can really minimize that and then just run and focus in on just like some really, I think, intimate aspects of running where it's like, I really only have to think about, you know, one step, or like I can really tune into what my body's saying and telling me, because I don't have to be crowding out these thoughts of, you know, the varying aspects of a undulating course. So, you know, that part of it kind of clicked for me and I really liked that. And I also liked the aspect where it's pretty comparable from one year to the next, or if I wanted to compare myself to what other folks have done in the history of, you know, timed ultra events, it was a lot cleaner of a comparison. If I run 11:47 on a track in really good weather and then run 11:19 on a track in really good weather, it's like, I made an improvement and it's pretty objective versus, you know, I run a X time at Western States on a year where it's barely cracking the 80s. And then another time, another year when it hits 110 in the canyons, it's like, who knows how much of a difference that makes. It could be 2 hours and we wouldn't know for sure. So again, I think that's an exciting part of that side of the sport. But it's just different. So I think when you look at these things through the, anytime you find yourself doing an event like an ultra marathon, you got to look at it from like, where are the benefits? Where are the positive? Why am I actually here? What am I trying to do with this experience versus hyper-focusing on where the negatives are is where I think you get this kind of divide of like people who want to try a time event short loop course versus people who never want to get near it. So that was kind of like my view kind of from afar, or from like the big picture outlook. And then it gets to like, how do you actually prepare for something like that? Because it's one thing to say like, okay, this is what's going to happen. It's another thing to actually kind of run yourself through that. And one thing I found is just like really valuable for me was when I'm doing like kind of the final build up to the race itself, I'm almost always programming my training to be kind of weaknesses and least specific stuff kind of earlier in the plan. And I don't necessarily completely always like divide certain intensities into blocks and then move on to the next. When it gets to 100 miles and further, I get a lot closer to that for sure. And there are times where I do kind of really compartmentalize, but really what I'm angling at is making sure when I get to like, say 6 to 8 weeks out from the race, I'm just going like pushing a ton of my training load towards race specific stuff. So my first thought earlier in my career was, okay, I'm preparing myself physically for that environment, that specifics. I'm really dialing in what I'm going to need on race day. And it gives me an opportunity to practice things that are maybe a little more difficult to practice, like nutrition, fueling, hydrating, and getting that stuff dialed in too. And one thing I noticed after doing a few of them was like, there's a huge value add if you also use those kind of more race specific training sessions near the end of the program to visualize tough areas of the event. So You do a couple and you kind of recognize like, here's some spots that are tricky to get over mentally. These are some spots where it's like, you got enough miles in your legs, but enough to go where if you let your mind get into a negative spiral, it can be very easy to kind of lose your confidence, find yourself just like constantly trying to like battle negative self-talk. And you recognize where those spots are likely to occur. So it's easier to recognize when they're kind of creeping up and you can redirect quickly. And using the long runs to kind of practice that has been real valuable. So for example, let's say I'm doing a 30-mile long run. I'm going to do that for the physical development, but I'm also going to do it to like just visualize what it's going to be like to go from mile 70 to mile 100. And when I do that a handful of times leading into the race, when I get to that point during the race, it feels a lot more manageable because I don't feel like the last time I did it was the last time I ran 100 miles. I feel like I've got some mental reps in very recently, as recently as 2 weeks ago, which is when I'll usually put my final long run. And that just was very valuable for me because I'd get to that spot in the race and instead of thinking like, oh, I got 70 miles in my legs, 30 miles is still a long ways and kind of heading on that mental path, you think 30 miles left, that's just one more long run. I've done 6 to 8 of these, maybe more in that final lead up to the race itself. I really know what I'm doing here. My body's checking out. My mind is checking out. Let's just do one more long run. And then you kind of shift your mindset from I'm running 100 miles today to I'm running one more 30-mile long run. And the higher quality that becomes, the better my end result is. And I think that's where you want to get your mind to. So you just get better, I think, at recognizing where those opportunities are to practice that in training. And you also get better at recognizing where you're going to potentially want to lean into that, those experiences on race day as well.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the fact that, that you have started break or you went to break up your training, that you as mostly running on a track that, you trails actually help your body to adapt and be more adaptable, I guess. For people who are hard and fast trail runners and only run on dirt, is there an advantage to go the opposite way for them physically?
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good question. I think probably, my first thought is it's probably more mental. Cause I mean, like you said, it is a very, very unique experience to dial your head into that same kind of space and not having that kind of aesthetic visual experience that you're going to get on a lot of the trail courses. But physically, I think too, it's like, it's different enough to where if you're training for like a real mountain course, like a UTMB type of course where you're, you know, the winner, the course record holder is going to have a fair bit of hiking. I mean, Hard Rock would be another great example of this, where it's just, that's the reality. You're getting into a lot of kind of very unique mechanical movements. So getting onto a training plan that's going to have you prepared for a flat runnable course, I think is going to be really, really good to kind of just maybe increase your leg turnover a little bit, get a little bit of speed back, work on some things that are maybe a little more foreign to race day for a mountain 100 mile, but possibly valuable for, long-term health and development and things like that. So it's probably similar, just on the opposite angle of like, you give yourself an opportunity to like, you know, maybe your weakness is the mechanics in a very monotone, flat type of running, like type of style. So going through a training plan for a flat ultra is going to really work on those weaknesses. So then when you do go back to doing the, you know, mountainous stuff, you're kind of ahead of schedule a little bit in the sense that you probably have less weaknesses to fine tune in the early stages of the training plan than you maybe would have if you were just kind of rinsing and repeating on the technical mountain stuff.
I'll get back to my conversation with Zach in just a minute, but right now I'd like to take a minute to talk about Qi running. For those of you who have listened to this podcast from the beginning, first of all, thank you. You might have heard my conversation with master Qi running instructor Lisa Pozzoni. I had two episodes with her, episode 44 and episode 13. If you would like to hear her take on what Qi running is about, you can check those episodes out. Qi running takes the principles of Tai Chi, posture and alignment, having correct posture and aligning your body and moving from your core, takes these principles and applies them to running. I was talking with a personal trainer this week, and he couldn't believe it when I told him that I actually use my legs less for running uphill than I do on the flats. I'm looking to work on my upper body strength to increase my hill climbing ability. Qi running is what's made it possible for me to run ultramarathons, the kind of distances that I run, and I don't have the kind of stress injuries that most runners get. It worked so well for me, I decided to become certified as an instructor. And so if you live in the Kansas City area, I'm available for private lessons, and I have workshops scheduled in the Kansas City area. I limit my workshops to 6 people so I can give the kind of attention to help you learn Qi running for yourself. If you're not in the Kansas City area, I can help you get connected to an instructor in your area. Qi running instructors are worldwide. It is still growing. There are new instructors coming on all the time. I also offer video form analysis, either local or online. There's a link on the website, ultramindsetpodcast.run, and you can find out more information about Qi running there and also contact me if you have more questions. Now, back to my conversation with Zach Bitter. Yeah, one of the reasons I ask is because I noticed a big difference. I had a trail race. I mean, most trail races you can't determine, you know, what kind of conditions you're going to face. And I ended up with a DNF. It was my first attempt at 100. My friends convinced me to go 6 weeks later for a 100-mile race that was on gravel roads. Mm-hmm. And I had at that year I'd probably only run maybe 30 miles on roads. And so I noticed that I did not feel physically prepared for running, for making that switch right away. And so, yeah, I try to keep my training mixed up so that I do some road work as well as trail running. I feel like that makes it me better. And that's why I asked you the question of if it worked the other way for you. But you talked a little bit about your nutrition, and I know you've kind of, as a coach, nutrition is kind of a big thing that you talk about. What, for someone who's, kind of the average runner, what kind of recommendations do you have for nutrition? What mm-hmm. do people look at?
Yeah, I think this is where ultra running stands out a little bit from a lot of the other running distances, because it's just such a different kind of timeline. Or time frame, I should say. So people think of endurance sports, a lot of times like the marathon is kind of the pinnacle in terms of distance and time on feet of what you're going to kind of experience. So a lot of the nutrition information and sports nutrition and things are kind of catered towards this scenario of like periodized training plans, where the fast stuff, like the short intervals, long intervals, tempo runs, and that sort of stuff are going to be kind of some of the cornerstone workouts that are going to be very close to kind of race pace and things like that. And then you're in this situation where like you're running fast enough, your body's demanding a high enough amount of oxygen through the metabolites that you're going to end up in a situation where like you got to have a fast fuel source at some point, and defending glycogen is going to be skewed very heavily towards carbohydrate in a lot of cases, especially with the shorter endurance events. And you get a lot of kind of moderate to high carb approaches for those very reasons in those distances. Now you get into an event, like I would say certainly in North America, kind of the 100-mile distance is this like target distance for a lot of ultra runners. People do plenty of other ones. Some folks will ultimately say, hey, I really like 50Ks, 50 miles, 100Ks, something short of 100 miles, and they're going to stay there. And that's totally fine. I think that's what we'll see more of as the sport grows and interest kind of grows as well. But a lot of people are going to try to get to 100 miles at some point, and that's kind of their end goal or their big target type of distance. And, for the average person, we're looking at 20 to 30 hours for their race day, like timeline, in a lot of cases, which just brings the intensity way down. So now you have this situation where the race is long. So everyone kind of just assumes they're gonna have to eat something during the race and drink stuff. And they're right. They are going to want to do that. But with the intensity being as low, we have a scenario where you're not at this point where you necessarily need to speed up the fuel source quite as much. And I think you still have this goal that's going to cross all athletes, which is I need to defend muscle glycogen. So that's going to be kind of your small fuel tank. Even the leanest athletes out there are going to have enough body fat where that fuel tank is much larger than their glycogen stores and is going to get them through on a single day ultra marathon. So really like defending muscle glycogen is the kind of the key target for folks. And then it kind of becomes this scenario of, or this multi kind of question kind of process that I think everyone has to go through is, first of all, how much food can I tolerate to take in during the race itself? And then is that going to be enough to defend muscle glycogen? And, I've worked with hundreds of athletes on this very question. And it's like, it's always amazing to me how you'll get some folks who it's like, they could just shovel food down all day long, have no digestion issues, and just keep cruising along. So that person's going to be able to defend their muscle glycogen quite easy on pretty much any diet they want. Most people are probably coming into the sport with at least a moderate carbohydrate foundation. That's just kind of traditionally where people sit, even outside of the endurance world. So like if that person is there, we're looking at just like kind of, well, what have we seen in the literature that would indicate like the fueling needs for someone on a moderate carbohydrate diet? And that would indicate around 50 to 70 grams of carbohydrate per hour. If they can tolerate that on race day without having too much digestive issues that are going to sideline their race or ruin their race, then cool. That's probably a perfectly fine path forward for them. Some people can't. You get to these scenarios where you have a race, you have a big digestive issue, or you don't have a digestive issue, but you just cannot stomach the fueling. And you have to kind of have this discussion with yourself or your coach or whomever and decide like, can I train myself to be able to take in more? If so, then maybe that's a worthwhile path to go to try to train yourself to be able to stomach and tolerate that. Or you can increase your fat oxidation rates so that the ratio of fats and carbs that you're going to metabolize at a given intensity is skewing more towards fats than it was previously, and reduce the amount of carbohydrate you're going to need to consume during the event in order to defend glycogen. So that's kind of the pathway I took, partly for some of those reasons we discussed. Is just was kind of nauseating and difficult for me to get up into that 50 to 70 gram range consistently and feel like I could trust my digestion during a race. So that was part of the process. You know, other people have other reasons. Some people are just prefer a low carbohydrate diet, or they're using it for some other reason outside of performance, and that's just their way of life. So they're like, well, how do I make this fit into this training program I'm doing? And really just kind of comes down to that. And you know, we're in an area with ultra running, regardless of whether you're moderate, high, low carbohydrate, or somewhere, you know, it's just very little of it's actually studied. You know, you definitely can find people who are willing to talk authoritatively about it, but really they're just extrapolating most research from shorter distance stuff, what I would consider relatively unrelative, certainly to the 100-mile distance, into ultra marathon, and saying, well, this is best evidence. And to some degree, they're correct with that, which is why I don't mind having a starting point at that. But ultimately, like, you, when you start getting to coaching individuals, you realize pretty quickly that, you know, it's not a formula. It's not a one sheet. I hand you this, you do that, and then we're good to go. It's an exploration, especially when we're getting into races that take this long. There's a lot of different opportunities. So I think generally speaking, what I like to do with an athlete is, first of all, whatever approach we take, it needs to be sustainable. Like, we need to find a way to make this work for you. So it's not something that's just going to get you through this training block, but you're not actually going to be able to adhere to that. So that's one of the questions we go through. And then we start looking at it through like that lens I was talking about before, where like, we got to defend muscle glycogen so that you're staying on top of that over the course of your day. So you're feeling strong at the end of the race versus feeling like the wheels are kind of coming off in the later stages. So then folks who struggle to take in their nutrition, they don't want to try to train their gut in a way that you would maybe have to do in order to be able to tolerate that sort of fueling for that length of time. Can kind of go to a little bit of a lower carbohydrate approach to do that, or kind of tap into that a little bit. And then it just becomes kind of a bit of a process. Cause like with most endurance training programs, you're going to have variability from one phase of this training season to another, where, you know, maybe we are working on some shorter intervals and things like that early in the plan, you know, a little more speed work focused. Well, for that phase of the training, we probably do want relatively a little more carbohydrate than we will at the end stage, where you're working on race pace stuff, which tends to be, like we said, quite slow. And then it's just kind of like playing around with that with the person and finding out kind of where good starting points are. You know, are their workouts improving versus regressing or stagnating? Like, looking at kind of like the performance side of things to kind of determine whether what they're doing is working or not working. And also like being honest with, like, you know, what is actually going to move the needle on the race day performance is like, if this person takes on a lower carbohydrate diet and it costs them a few percentages in performance on their short intervals, but it allows them to better execute their long runs, handle their nutrition with a little more certainty, then are we like, where's the net gain or loss in that equation? So, I mean, it's always a little bit of guesswork with ultra marathon because there's hundreds and hundreds of inputs when it comes to race day performance, when you get out into, you know, events that take this long. So, I think it's kind of part of the fun project, I think, is kind of looking at that wide open landscape more or less and figuring out, okay, we have options, which is good. We just need to find the option that's going to give you the best path forward for your own particular set of circumstances versus, you know, trying to get too myopic with any type of nutrition programming that would be kind of unique to endurance, but maybe not so much when we extrapolate it out into long time frames, like 20, 30 hours and things like that.
And I know that in some of your social media, some of the times you've mentioned intermittent fasting. Is that something that is incorporated into your training plans, or how, if somebody is, I mean, and that's it's a pretty big topic. There's people who practice that and swear by it. Just wondered what your feelings are about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't do a whole lot of structured intermittent fasting for myself. It's weird because like for me, I understand like why people would want to do intermittent fasting. And I think it's not something you need to necessarily avoid at all costs if you're doing endurance sport or you're doing ultra marathons and things like that. But for me, it's like when I get into kind of peak training, it becomes more of a hurdle to get enough in than it does to like try to limit the time window in feeding. And I'm also looking at it through maybe a slightly different lens than some people are, where I'm looking at it like, well, there's this performance thing that I'm trying to fine tune, and that's kind of my driver. And I don't necessarily see a huge value add in intermittent fasting in terms of improving my fat oxidation rates more than I need to. Like, my fat oxidation rates are already high enough for me to be able to take on the fueling strategy that I'm almost certain isn't going to create a digestive issue. So, you know, for me, for a 100-mile race, for example, I'm probably going to target about 30 to 40 grams of carbohydrate an hour. And that's kind of the number where I'll have to defend muscle glycogen. So if I can tolerate that digestively, then I don't really need to push the needle on fat adaptation any further. So that's another piece of confusion, not to kind of step away from the question too far, but I mean, people sometimes think of this as all or nothing, right? They're like, carbs or no carbs.
Right. And there are people I've heard ultra runners say, you know, don't eat anything. You know, people who are fat adapted and you say that, it's like you could run 100 miles and not have to eat anything, you know, just drink water.
Yeah. I mean, you can definitely do it. I mean, Mike McKnight has. So, you know, there's people who've done that. I think, Mike will be the first person to tell you, like, if he's looking to execute his race as best as he possibly can, he's going to be eating some stuff during it. Now, Mike is low carb, so he's going to be defending muscle glycogen with a lot less than what someone who's moderate or high carb is going to need to do. And that works well for him. And I think when you get to the realm of, this is an interesting topic, because I think, like, no eating is, you're going to be burning high levels of fat. There's no way around it. I think, like, even if someone on a moderate carbohydrate diet decided they're going to try to do a fasted 100 miler, I'm not 100% sure they wouldn't be able to. I think, like, there would be some upregulation in their fat oxidation rates just in order to get through it. They may have a much more volatile experience than someone like Mike, who's certainly trained his body, you know, so performance may take a much bigger hit for that person than they would for someone like Mike, who's going to just, you know, even if he is eating during a race, he's going to be burning higher rates of fat and carbohydrate ratios than the average moderate high carb athlete in most cases. So, there's that. So I think, like, it just depends. It's like, what are we looking here for in performance? And I think intermittent fasting, like, if I'm working with someone and they're like, hey, I've gained 20 pounds and I want to get back down to that weight that I know I race well at. And when I tried these different dietary protocols, I have a really hard time sticking to it. But if I eat intermittent fasting, if I do like a 16-8 window or something like that, I can stay within my target. It makes it easier for me. And then that gets them down to that kind of ideal power weight ratio, their best weight for racing and things like that. Then, you know, intermittent fasting is probably going to be a tool that helps their improvement. Get someone like myself who, you know, after the first maybe 4 to 6 weeks into a training plan, I'm at race weight basically at that point. And then it's like, if I start dipping below that, that's where I start seeing the performance dip. So if I restrict my feeding window to 8 hours, 4 hours, or whatever that happens to be, I just run the risk of undershooting my energy intake. And that's just a little more of a risk to my performance than I'd like. So I tend not to do it that, like, in any type of, like, strict manner during, like, training buildups and things like that. In off season, you know, I'll play around with some of this stuff because I am curious about it. You know, I've been doing low carb for over 10 years now. So, like, when these different kind of, like, types of low carbohydrate, because I think that's the other thing is that people think, like, oh, the ketogenic diet, and that kind of, like, is this umbrella term for, like, the whole thing, where in reality you could have low carb keto, which is going to range from, like, basically no carbs to, you know, upwards to maybe even 30% of your intake from carbohydrate. And then you're going to have the different iterations of it from, like, mostly plant-based or all plant-based, or, like, mostly animal-based, all animal-based, and everything in between. And so there's so many different kind of angles to hit the macronutrients you're looking for to kind of fit within whatever definition we have going. And, you know, I do get curious about that stuff, but I usually reserve it for the off season. So, like, if I'm going to do any sort of, like, planned fasting or things like that, it's most likely going to be in the off season when I'm not demanding, you know, 2 to 3 times my resting metabolic rate on a given training day. When I'm not, like, thinking of performance as my primary goal at the moment, I'm more kind of resetting the body and mind for what's coming up next and deciding what it is I want to build up for and things like that. It just gives me a little bit of a better, I think, place to maybe play around with some of that stuff.
Yeah, cool. Well, I wanted to take a minute and ask you a little bit about your podcast. You said you got into podcasting, and it's called the Human Performance Outliers. And mm-hmm. you looks like you interview people who who've done some rather astounding things. So talk a little bit about what's been your experience and kind of your purpose for the podcast.
Yeah, that's been kind of fun. Cause I kind of said in the beginning, like podcasting as a guest was one of my favorite things to do when I first got into ultra running. It was just a cool platform. So at a certain point I got around to thinking, well, you know, if it's this much fun as a guest, it's worth checking out as a host. So I'm trying to think of what the actual date was. That I think it was in 2017, maybe 2017, 2018. One of those, it was a while ago. Mm-hmm. I think probably 18. And, I just reached out to another guy who was at the time like low carb keto. He was a little more strict keto than I was, but he was totally like on the opposite end of the spectrum from a like sport target. It was all high intensity stuff, like 60 seconds or less. He had some like age group world records on the Concept 2 rowing machine. He had participated in the Highland Games. He was a professional rugby player at the time, orthopedic surgeon, like all sorts of like interesting little things. So like I was like, okay, this might be a cool kind of co-hosting podcast where we have like the explosive sport athlete, the long run all day athlete, kind of both following a low carb ketogenic diet. This will be kind of a fun avenue to explore. So we started out doing it that way. We wanted to kind of keep it kind of open to like basically tons of different topics. We didn't want to get too like focused in on any one thing, which I think was kind of fun because it was allowed us to like explore topics that would just kind of come up in the news or things that we were interested mm-hmm. in or questions that people would ask about throughout the, you know, just the discussions around episodes and things like that. So we went down like, you know, rabbit holes on protein requirements, on the different types of athletes that use low carb versus high carb and why they ended up there and things like that. And then lifestyle too, like that we had a lot of guests on that weren't target any sort of physical performance, but it was more like I had this issue and I took on this dietary protocol and this is my experience and things like that. And then a lot of researchers like doctors and things like that come on and talk about their experience with things like that. And that's kind of where we went. At a certain point, my co-host Dr. Sean Baker and I both kind of got busy and our schedules didn't match up as well anymore. So in order to kind of continue to release episodes, I started taking it on as a solo host about, I think, a year and a half ago. If I'm remembering right. Yeah. About a year and a half ago. So, I try to keep it still kind of more health, fitness and sport related versus just all running. I think a lot of the solo podcasts where I'm just kind of doing listener questions, answers and topics tend to be a little more skewed towards running and low carb performance on that side of things, because people just probably aren't going to ask me like, oh, you know, how do I, maximize my deadlift or something like that? Whereas with Sean, that was very much something he could answer. So it skews probably a little more towards endurance now than it did in the past, but I like to kind of keep it open to a variety of different topics because it is one of the reasons I liked it in the first place was it was a little bit of an opportunity to explore some worlds that were different from running, since so much of my day-to-day is, you know, coaching, training, racing and all that stuff. It's like kind of a nice little like, here's something to do that's maybe not quite as specific to that type of thing. And that was kind of an exciting piece to it too.
Yeah. And that's the thing I've enjoyed about podcasting is there's some flexibility I think if the listeners, if it's like, it's not something that not a topic they're interested in, they'll skip it and come back next week.
But, yeah. Yeah. You get kind of your core listeners who are just like, hey, I really can pull something out of basically any one of these episodes, so I'm going to listen to all of them. And then you get the folks who are like, oh, cool, that guest, I want to hear what they have to say. And then you sort of see like those folks kind of, fit into, you know, some shape or form in terms of whatever download a certain episode gets and things like that. But yeah, it's a cool platform for sure. And it's been a fun journey.
Yeah. And you get to talk to people who, you know, just if you would never, you'd never think about approaching necessarily is, mm-hmm. you look them up and I have been appreciative of the number of people who've been willing to come on and just, you know, mm-hmm. just have a quick conversation, you know, have a conversation for an hour. And,
mm-hmm. Yeah. People are pretty receptive. I found, you know, about coming on podcasts. Usually it's like, you know, I think sometimes people think like, oh, well, if I reach out to so-and-so, they're going to not answer, or they're going to not come on because I've got this little podcast, or I just started this podcast, and why would they want to come on this platform and they could go on that one? It's like, I don't know, people like to have discussions, I think, especially nowadays when so much of our lives are kind of through these snapshot type headline things. It's, you know, an opportunity to sit down and actually talk to somebody versus, you know, try to decipher what this like 140 character message actually means.
Yeah, that's true. So do you have anything that, that is on, your, in your view of, something that, you know, goals set goals ahead of you? I mean, you've had the world record, and, I mean, that's like become like the 4 minute mile when it was first, someone broke 12 hours and now everyone's trying to lower it. And I know that,
now we've got a sub 11 hour out there. It's crazy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So do you have, is that something you'll go for, or do you have a, you know, another race that you'd like to, you know, kind of your dream race or something you'd like to do?
Yeah, I think I would say when I first ran Desert Solstice in 2013, a huge driver to me wanting to kind of go back to those type of courses or those type of events was to target the world record for 100 miles. And it took me about just under 6 years to finally get there. And through that process, I think I actually learned what I was actually motivated by. I think like you get anyone who has a long ultra running career, I can almost guarantee you their goals and their objectives have evolved to some degree over the course of that. I think that's what keeps them in it mentally. So for me, one of those kind of transitions was I ended up getting a little more interested in just what is it that I can actually do in this sport of ultra marathon running in a controllable 100 mile, like how fast can I go? And there's enough interesting, exciting aspects to the sport where if I hit that spot where I'm like, I'm just not going a second faster in this, then I'll move on to something else. So like when I ran 11:19 for 100 miles, you know, my first thought was, I think I can go under 11 hours. And, you know, so that's kind of a goal for me, is to continue to see how fast I can go. You know, the world record now has been lowered to 10 hours and 51 minutes, and it'll actually potentially come down to closer to 10:48 because the course that it was done on by, Alex Sorkin was, they only counted a completed lap, and you happened to hit 100 miles like midway through one of the laps, and the laps were like roughly a mile. So he ended up running about a half a mile past 100 miles in order to get to that end lap, which got him to that 10:51 number. I believe they're going to actually measure the course and find exactly where the 100 mile mark was and then give him his actual 100 mile time, which would be cool.
That would be cool. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's, you know, there's obviously, I think like, that mark is within reach. It's going to take everything I got, no doubt, but like, I don't think it's out of reach. Even if it was, I'd probably still keep going, because if I have any opportunity of going under 11:19, it's worth it for me to just kind of get to that point that I described before, where I could feel like I maximize my potential with this particular endeavor. And, that would be kind of a cool thing to be able to, I think, eventually retire on. So, not anytime soon, hopefully, but, at some point I'll probably want to not at least competitively race anymore, I would imagine. But yeah, so I do have a race I'm going to probably do in June. That's going to be, you know, a fast 100 mile setup like that. So that's kind of what I'm preparing for now. I'm looking forward to actually this buildup, because the last 2 years have just been so goofy with the pandemic, where, you know, I went from like a formula that worked really well for me, where I would do roughly 6 to 8 ultra marathons in a year, with 2 or 3 of them being kind of target races. And the other ones were just like highly structured, long runs essentially. And I really liked that because it kept me out in the community every like month or two. It let me practice just like kind of race day logistics. What do I do the night before, the morning of, aid station navigation, that sort of stuff, allowed me fine tune those things. And as long as I kept myself honest and didn't go 100% on those B races, it didn't really negatively impact, at least as far as I could tell, my goal A races. And you just didn't have really opportunities to do much racing at all in 2020, fewer opportunities in 2021. So I've been kind of a little bit removed from that formula the past couple of years. And I think now we're, you know, we're at a point where I've kind of got some things set up in a way where I can do some tune-up races. So I'll probably do a few like 50K to 100K type distance stuff in the meantime before that June timeline, but that's kind of the goal, is a fast 100 mile in the June.
Okay. Okay. So you're looking to do the sub 1150 in June.
Yeah, so there. I'll go back to the same event that I did that I ran 11:19 at in 2019, the Pettit Center in Milwaukee. And so June obviously wouldn't be very conducive for fast 100-miling outside in most cases. But the Pettit Center is an indoor track, and they have climate control because there's a speed skating rink there. So it's kind of a nice environment to kind of go after that sort of stuff at.
Yeah, and I'd seen that. And do they put the track over the ice, or do they? Is it? Do they let the ice melt and just use it dry?
Yeah, it's really interesting, actually. So they built the facility for a speed skating rink and I think three hockey rinks originally. And when they were building it, I think it was just like, well, it makes sense to put a track around this. You have the space. And the funny part is most indoor facilities, like they're 200 meters for a lot of the collegiate stuff, indoor track surfaces, mostly just because I think it's like pretty hard to make a 400-meter track that you can actually build a facility around. And since they had to do the speed skating rink and ice and hockey rinks anyway, they couldn't even get it short enough to be 400 meters. So it's actually like 438 meters or something around there. So that was kind of an add-on, I think, but it was a welcomed add-on as far as I'm concerned. Because
so it's a track, it's a running track around the speed skating track.
Yep. So it operates independently of the actual speed skating rink and hockey rinks. So you can have people out there running and people skating at the same time. In fact, at the event itself at the Pettit Center, there was a couple hockey games that took place between the start and the finish. And they were resurfacing the speed skating rink at the time, so there weren't any speed skaters out there. But I'd actually done an indoor marathon there at one point a long time ago when I was still living in Wisconsin, I think maybe in like 2014, 2015, somewhere around that timeline. And that time, I think there were some speed skaters out there. But
so how people hear this, how can they get a hold of you? What's your best way to get in touch with you?
Yeah, a lot of my stuff from coaching to social media links and things can be found on my website at zachbitter.com, as well as the landing page for my podcast. So that's kind of the easiest spot to find everything. Probably most active on Instagram, which is just at zachbitter, Twitter at zbitter.
Okay. Well, thanks. Before you go, I have started something new. I'm calling it the bridge questions. Three questions before you leave.
Who approaches the bridge of death must answer me these questions three. The other side he see.
Ask me the questions, Bridgekeeper. I'm not afraid.
The first one is, what piece of gear is your must-have gear?
That's a good question. On race day, I'm guessing we're talking here, or does it not matter?
Usually race day, yeah, but I mean, you can. It's your question.
Okay, cool. Well, I think in the spirit of running, I'm probably going to have to go with shoes, right? That's going to like square one, so to speak, unless you're going to go barefoot, which you do see from time to time. Actually, funny story. At one point, I did a track ultra, and I had like trained my lower legs to be able to tolerate just basically a racing flat minimalist shoe. So I had this like 3.8-ounce shoe, and I was like, I'm going to have the lightest shoe out here. And then I get to the race, and there were three guys there who are running completely barefoot. I'm like, I've got this 3.8-ounce shoe, and I've got it's only fourth on the list of lightest footwear today.
So did it have arch support? Did that flat
have my shoes support? Did?
Yeah, your shoes.
No, it was basically just like a flat platform, very little midsole, which is what I was looking for. You know, I wanted that response. It's interesting because it's like, you know, footwear from a performance standpoint now has, you know, this is one of the biggest transitions probably in the sport from when I started, is just racing flats are now max cushion because the foam material provides, depending on your mechanics and the brand, anywhere from 2 to 8% performance improvement. So now most brands are making super shoes as far as their racing shoes. So it's like, it's gone to the other end of the spectrum in terms of the type of footwear that most people are going to be racing in these days. And it's kind of like the steel frame to carbon frame bike transition, I guess, in the running world. I would have never guessed that would be something that would be an aspect to consider, but here we are.
That's interesting. And was, I know you're sponsored, or you're involved with Ultra
Footwear. Yeah.
Ultra Footwear. Yeah. So was the shoe that one, you know, when you were sponsored by Ultra, or was it, I mean, do they make one that's that small, that's that minimalist?
Yeah, they did at the time. It was called the Vanish. I actually helped design that shoe. And then since that was going to be like the racing flat, and now since you know, everything's skewing towards super shoes, they've got one coming out in, I believe, early April of their own that they're going to build off of the Vanish upper. So it's going to be called the Vanish C, and that'll be their kind of racing shoe. Now it'll have that like kind of more beefy midsole with that really light, very responsive midsole component in there. And so that's the shoe of choice for me. I wore actually the Solstice for the 1119 I wore back in 2019. So I'd have to, someone made a comment about this, I think near the end of the year, where, cause you know, a lot of records have gone down in the last 4 or 5 years, and you know, some of it's just progression of the sport, but some of it's also, you know, the shoe performance stuff. So like, mm-hmm. I think I might've had the only world record that year that wasn't done in a super shoe, but I could be wrong about that. I have to double check. There's probably some age group, but I'm guessing there's some age group ones out there that were done, but maybe outright world records. So my claim to fame going forward is going to be, I have the fastest 100 mile in a normal shoe.
that's good. Okay. Second question. What is the most overrated exercise that runners do?
Oh, geez, gosh, I'm going to get myself in trouble here, I'm sure. Cause well, it's I always,
I know it's, but you know, well, this is your opinion. So
yeah. I would say probably if we're talking like endurance runners, I would say it's maybe not the design, but the practice. I think when people do like short intervals, they end up making it basically a sprint. And in most cases, you actually want your short intervals to be like, first of all, evenly paced across like the spectrum of how many repetitions you're going to do. But you don't necessarily want to be kind of pushing to like all out what we would consider HIIT workouts, where like you can really only sustain it for like a handful of seconds. So I would say like, if you're a runner and you're doing like, I know like this is going to get confusing for people because some people will call like a short interval a HIIT workout, a high intensity interval training session. But really, by definition, like HIIT is like all out, like max effort. And you can only handle that for a few seconds at a time. So like if you are doing HIIT sessions as like a distance runner, that's probably a little overrated in terms of what it's actually going to do for you from a racing performance standpoint.
Okay. Well, that's a good answer. I like that. Okay. Last question. What is your word or phrase that best represents your philosophy of life and running?
Curiosity would be the one that I would pick. I think that's what's kept me in running. That's what originally got me interested in running. And I think that's will probably be what drives, you know, however many races I do going forward, is just being curious about what I can do. And then also curious about what other types of events and things there are out there, you know, whether it's be the actual race itself or the things I like to kind of tie to it all.
That's good. I like that. Thank you a lot, Zach. I appreciate you. Appreciate you being here.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for listening to this episode. I really do appreciate you being here. If you do want to connect with Zach, check out the show notes at ultramindsetpodcast.run. I remember it's .run, not .com. I still sometimes enter it wrong, sometimes even say it wrong. So it's ultramindsetpodcast.run for the show notes. You can also find there a link to the Chi Running Workshop. I've got one coming up on May 7th, 2022. This is a few weeks away from when this episode is going to drop. You can get more information there and sign up. There's also a place on that site to leave comments, questions, and stories. You can also book a free 25-minute mindset reset call with me. And if you're on a phone, make sure you scroll to the bottom. And the computer, all of this stuff, all the links and the things that I'm talking about for the comments, questions, and stories. There's an Amazon affiliate link, booking a free call with me. All of those things are on the sidebar on a computer, but on your phone, you have to scroll clear to the bottom. So check those things out if you would like to connect with me or find out more information about Chi Running and the workshops that I offer. If you like the show and know somebody else who might be a runner, or just looking for some inspiration to either start running or run farther, take a minute, tell them about it. I appreciate that. That is how I've helped this show to grow. Remember, an ultramarathon mindset is what you need for success, whether you're running or just living your life. And developing a strong mindset is a skill you can learn. Thanks again for listening. See you next time.